dead. One person was killed last night. The military says the gunman was a member of the Sons of Iraq, a Sunni group that broke with insurgents and cooperated with U.S.-led forces. Last Saturday, members of another Sunni group clashed with police after their leader was arrested on terrorism charges. Thousands more people have turned out for another anti-government rally in Ukraine. They pack Kiev's main square, protesting the government's handling of the economy and calling for resignations. Ukraine's economy contracted by nearly 30% in the first 2 months of this year. As many as 1 million people may be unemployed. President Viktor Yushchenko ruled out early presidential and parliamentary elections, saying there were no legal grounds for them. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Citco, working for nearly a century to fuel the entrepreneurial spirit through its locally owned stations, providing opportunities for people with dreams.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose initiative on immigration, history, and policy presents Global Economic Change and Migration of Asian Women, What Are the Issues? By Jean Pyle on Monday, April 6th at noon at the Center for Advanced Study, 912 West Illinois in Urbana.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. I'm sorry that we cannot talk this morning as we had planned with writer Juno Diaz, author of The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, a novel. We hope that sometime in the future we can have him on the program. I do want to mention that he is scheduled to be on the campus of the University of Illinois next week to give a reading. This is Wednesday, April 8th, 5 in the afternoon at the Natural History Building, and it's open to anybody who would want to attend. Instead, here in this hour, we'll go to the archives for a conversation with anthropologist Ruth Behar. We talked in January about her book, An Island Called Home, so do keep in mind as you listen to this hour, Focus will not take calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Ruth Behar. She's professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. She has lived most of her life in the United States, but she was born in Cuba. She and her family were among those Cubans who left the country when Fidel Castro came to power. Going back to the period before the World War II, there were significant numbers of European Jews in Cuba, people who actually had come there, thinking that that would be a stopover on their way to America. Now, it didn't work out that way for most of them, and many of them actually ended up staying, living in Cuba and making it their home. And then most of them ended up leaving after Castro came to power. And among them were Ruth Behar, who at the time was just a little girl, and her family. Now, she talks about the fact that she really had no memories of Cuba. She was just too young when the family left. But it was something, it was a connection that for her somehow always remained strong and something that she felt that she really needed to follow up on. She says she also was very curious on what remained of the Jewish community in Cuba, and over a period of years made a number of trips back to try both to satisfy that curiosity about what remained of Jewish life in Cuba and also to make some kind of personal connection or reconnection to her family and its history there in Cuba. And she's authored a book that gets at satisfying both those kinds of interests. It's recently been published. The title of her book is An Island Called Home, Returning to Jewish Cuba. You can find it in the bookstore. It's published by the Rutgers University Press. You can read the book. Also, if you're interested in finding out more about her and some of her work as an anthropologist, you can take a look at her website, ruthbehar.com. Her last name is spelled B-E-H-A. She is a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellows Award. She's the author of The Vulnerable Observer, Anthropology That Breaks Your Heart, and also director of the documentary Adio Querida, A Cuban Sephardic Journey. And she's talking with us this morning by telephone. Professor Behar, hello.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. You begin here the book with a little story about your grandmother, and writing about the fact that over a period of time when you were going to Cuba quite a lot, as an academic, you could you could do that. You were going and you would pass through Miami, where she was living, to see her. And she apparently continued over this time would continue to ask this question, what are you doing here? Why are you going? She said, right here, the first line of the book is, you're going to Cuba again? What did you lose in Cuba?
That's right. Well, it's kind of a line in Cuban Spanish, que se te perdió en Cuba, like que se te perdió. What did you lose in that place that you have to keep going back? And a very Cuban expression. And she kept asking me that question because, like the rest of my family, it would have been okay for me to go, you know, two or three times would have been more than enough to just see what we left behind. But it became a kind of obsessive journey for me, especially throughout the 90s, which was also the last decade of her life. And I just had to keep going back and reconnect or see if I could reconnect. And as I say, each journey involved a visit with my grandmother, my Yiddish-speaking Baba, from Poland, who had immigrated to Cuba as a 20-year-old woman in the 1920s. And, you know, part of it was, of course, a little heartbreaking because she would have liked me to have stayed for two or three weeks with her in Miami instead of being with her for two or three days and then going off to Cuba.
Mm. And for other members of your family, particularly for your parents, what did they think of your going to Cuba?
Well, you know, initially in the early years, there weren't that many people traveling to Cuba in the early 90s. And so they were very concerned for me. I think a lot of Cubans who left in the early 60s when we did left under quite a lot of duress. It wasn't an easy time to get out of Cuba. And people, your former neighbors, you know, called you gusano or worm if you left. And so you were harassed and my mother was strip searched at the airport when we left. And so people who left in that era, I mean, I really feel for them. They just went through a lot of pain and sorrow, and many of them left rather suddenly, too. And so there's a kind of fear and paranoia about going back for that generation. And I think since I was so young, since I was a little girl, I didn't really understand what was going on. I just thought we were, you know, somehow going on a vacation, even though we had never left Cuba. And so I think I didn't quite understand, so I didn't quite suffer the trauma that my parents and other people of their generation did. So I think every time I went back, it kind of spurred, you know, those memories again of leaving, and there I was going back, and all they could remember was having to leave. So I think it was a very emotional thing, and they were just very worried for me. They were concerned that if I spoke out about the political situation or spoke in any way, you know, honestly or publicly to people, that I might get in trouble in Cuba, that I might be jailed. And so I think they were just very worried. They don't have a clear sense of what, you know, life is like in Cuba today, and I think they were just worried for me. And every time I would go, my mother would, you know, talk to me on the phone. My parents are in New York, and she would say goodbye, but my father never wanted to talk to me before I went on my trips because he just really didn't want me to go at all.
Mm. Oh, was he somehow afraid that you wouldn't come back?
That was a fear for a while, I think, that I might, you know, somehow not be allowed to leave. And I have to tell you that every time I'm in Cuba, once I get there, I'm delighted, and I have so many wonderful friends there and people that I've met that I really appreciate. But whenever I'm ready to leave and I'm at the airport, that last moment before I have to go through immigration and security, I actually do start getting a cold sweat because that paranoia is kind of, you know, ingrained in me, even though I've gone many times to Cuba, I've never had any problems. But I think, you know, there's an emotional level to this that is just kind of too deep, in a sense, to control. But what has happened is I've now been back so many times, and, you know, I wrote the book and I made the documentary, that I think I've been able to show my parents and my family that there are good people in Cuba, and, you know, there is a Jewish community. And so I've brought back kind of all these stories and all this information that I think has helped them to, you know, to understand what I'm doing and to not feel that huge fear every time that I go back.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Ruth Behar. She's professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. And if you would like to read about her experiences, the book to look for is her new book. It's titled An Island Called Home, Returning to Jewish Cuba. It is published by the Rutgers University Press. Has text and also a lot of nice photographs in there as well. And if you'd like to call in here on the program, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So how old were you when you and your family left Cuba?
I was 4 and a half when we left, and we actually went to Israel first for a year, and then from Israel we moved to New York because the majority of my mother's family ended up moving to New York, and they just didn't want to be on their own in Israel. And it's kind of a funny story because when we left, my parents were in their mid-20s, and so they were very young, and they had me and my brother, two young children. They had never left the island, so they didn't have a passport, and they decided to leave after the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was April of 1961, and we left in May, and the U.S. Embassy had shut down, and so they had no way of leaving. But we had an uncle, my great-uncle, who had been a co-founder of a kibbutz near Tel Aviv. And so we left kind of one, you know, communist system for another in Israel, which I think was sort of funny. And, you know, so we were there for a year. My mother loved it. She just thought it was wonderful. But my father didn't like agricultural life. He was a real habanero, you know, somebody used to urban Havana life who liked the clubs and two-tone shoes. And so so he was definitely not somebody who was going to stay and be part of that world. And then my mother's family ended up moving to New York. So we left for New York and arrived in 1962 when I was 5 and a half. And I just went straight into a New York public school. Without not yet knowing any English, and you know, going through that immigrant experience of you know, not knowing how to communicate with people, and having to find my way in a new language. But like all immigrant kids, you know, I learned English quickly, and eventually kind of became a translator for my parents.
Well, and was your first language Spanish?
Yes, definitely. My first language is Spanish, and then my second was Hebrew. And then my third is English, because I didn't learn English till, you know, till I came to New York. So Spanish is still very much, you know, the language of the heart for me and for my family. And, you know, my grandparents, who were all immigrants on my mother's side from Poland and Russia, and on my father's side, Sephardic Jews from Turkey, we all spoke Spanish. You know, they, you know, that was the language that brought us all together. Not only in Cuba, but in the United States as well.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of wonderful photographs in the book. There are photographs of the people that you came to know in Cuba, and then there are also some family photographs of your family in here. And there's a wonderful picture here of you when you were a little girl with your mother at the famous seawall. That I guess that would be the Malecón. In Havana. So here's your mom, and here you are, totally adorable, in this little dress, standing up on the seawall. And I don't know how old you were in that photograph. Two, maybe, or three.
Yeah.
So here this would be something. I'm guessing you would look at that photograph. I don't know. I would be guessing you would not have any memory of that. So you're connecting to that, and probably to a lot of this time would be looking at pictures. That is, you would not have personal memories of having lived in Cuba at that time.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's a great insight. The way I recovered Cuba initially was, you know, in addition to all the stories that my family told me, was through these photographs, these old black and white photographs that my mother and my grandmother took with them out of Cuba. And they were my first window into what that Cuba was and who I was as this little girl, you know, who lived in Cuba in this very tumultuous era. And that photograph that you mentioned of me with my mother on the Malecón, it's just one of my very, very favorite photographs. I think my father took it, actually. And there's just something about it that's so magical. You know, my mother was so beautiful and young. I was this cute little girl. And it looked like we had this future, you know, to come in Havana. Havana in Cuba, no knowledge that, you know, soon after, a few years after, we would be leaving and starting a whole new life in the United States. And so I think these photographs for me were like a key, you know, back into this world that I couldn't remember because I was too young. I had a lot of inherited memories, but I didn't really have my own memories. So the photographs were this key, and I think, you know, when I started going back to Cuba so frequently, it was important to me to kind of create another archive of new black and white photographs of this Cuba that I was seeing, the new Cuba that I was seeing. And I had the very good fortune to meet the photographer who worked with me, Humberto Mayol, who is a Havana-based photographer, an amazing photojournalist who has taken thousands of pictures of contemporary Cuba. And I saw his work and really liked it, and asked him if he would work with me on this project. And he did, and so he kind of became a second pair of eyes looking at this new Jewish community that that I might have been a part of had we stayed. Mm-hmm.
Just also, I think it's important to make a point that your parents, they were not among those people that immediately left. Mm-hmm. They were, at least you write about your mom particularly in here, thinking, well, she was going to try to go with it at least there initially, so that there was not that immediate sense that things had changed to the point where they would have felt, well, we can't leave her anymore and we have to leave.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that was true for many, many Cubans, particularly middle-class Cubans, who in 59, 1960, they were still kind of, you know, waiting to see what was going to happen. And they had been the majority of Cubans, about 95% of Cuba, the Cuban people, supported the revolution. And my parents were part of that. They were very, very supportive of Fidel Castro, as mostly everybody was. People wanted a change from the very corrupt dictatorship that had existed previously. And they thought that, you know, Castro and Che and, you know, the whole group of revolutionaries were going to bring about, you know, a good democratic system, which was what people wanted. And so, yes, we didn't initially think of leaving. It wasn't until after the Bay of Pigs invasion that really my father made the decision to leave. That was the point at which Fidel Castro declared that the new system was going to be communist. Actually, you know, said that, declared that. And many, many people left soon after that declaration, my family among them. Those who were wealthier and kind of saw the writing on the wall earlier left, you know, right after 59, late 1959 or even 1960. But people who were more sort of part of the middle class, lower middle class, kind of didn't really feel threatened till after 61. That was also the point at which properties began to be nationalized, and particularly in the Jewish community, many people had small stores that were expropriated by the new revolutionary government. So people felt threatened economically and didn't want to stay and you know, work for a communist government, basically.
All right. We have someone who would like to talk with you, and we welcome people into the conversation. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, you have a question, comment, you'd like to join the conversation, you can do that. We have someone here. We'll welcome in, and they are in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hi. I was in the Peace Corps in Dominican Republic, and the Dominican Republic is like the next island over, and it's actually a very large Jewish population living there, and I was very surprised to go to this Caribbean island and see all these Jewish, you know, this whole Jewish community, and I was just, there are a lot of jokes in the DR about how when the Dominican Republic declared war on Hitler, Hitler just laughed. And so there's a lot of jokes about that, and they kind of just leave the community. The Jewish community is very tight-knit, and I was just wondering, you know, what's the story from getting from Europe over to Cuba? That's just amazing. How do people end up there? And then the in the Dominican Republic, they're very famous for their cheese that they make. And I was just wondering, you know, what kind of industries, I assume that it was started off agricultural because you mentioned that your father didn't care for that agricultural life. And, you know, was it hard? I mean, do you know anything about that part of it, like the part before you were born type stuff? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
No, thank you. Thanks for your question. That's really great. Yeah, the Dominican Republic is famous for a Jewish community in a town called Sosua, where many Jewish refugees settled. And it was kind of a very interesting and unique situation. What happened in Cuba, and one of the reasons the Jews went to Cuba and actually other Latin American countries, largely in the 1920s, was because most of them were trying to immigrate to the United States, but they couldn't. In 1924, the United States issued an Immigration Act that essentially sought to limit Jewish immigration and imposed a quota system. And so there were many Jews that were trying to flee between World War I and World War II, and Cuba didn't have any restrictions on Jewish immigration. And back in Europe, the Yiddish press actually advertised that if you could just get to Cuba, it was only 90 miles away from the United States, and it was so close that you could probably even swim there if you wanted to. So people kind of heard about Cuba and, you know, heard that it was this tropical island close to the United States, and so many immigrated to Cuba in that period, hoping to eventually basically jump over to the United States, but then for various reasons not doing so, either because they didn't have the financial means or they just fell in love with Cuba and stayed. And so that's how the community developed on the island. I think the immigration to the Dominican Republic was somewhat later, actually, in the war years, in the 30s and 40s, if I remember correctly. And the Jews who came to Cuba, they largely initially were street peddlers. That was true of both of my grandfathers and many other people that I know of. And they just went selling door-to-door, just watches and clothes and blankets and things like that. And many of them went off to the countryside where there were very few goods available for purchase. And they just started out as peddlers, and then eventually many of them were able to set up shops, little shops, not only in Havana, but all over the island, shops and kind of general stores, basically, where, as was the case with my mother's parents, my Aunt Sylvia describes it this way, that they sold everything from safety pins to mattresses. So they had these kinds of general stores, many of them off in the countryside.
It's interesting that you also talk about the Jewish community in Cuba, the fact that it was a diverse community in the sense that there were people who came there from Turkey. There were people who came there from Europe. There were also American Jews who came from the United States and went to Cuba, thinking that that would be a good, you know, place of opportunity for them. So that there were, in a sense, these three within the Jewish community in Cuba, there were these three rather distinct communities who spoke different languages, who came from different places, and that it was, they saw themselves as being outsiders, you know, perhaps might have seen them all as being one, but they saw themselves as being rather distinct communities. And I think you also mentioned the fact that your grandparents, one of them was of European origin, one was Sephardic, and that was considered to be a mixed marriage.
Yes, yes, I know. It's so interesting to think that it was such a small community, about, you know, 15 to 20,000 people, and yet there were all these distinctions within this very small community, cultural distinctions and linguistic distinctions. You know, the Jews that came from Eastern Europe, like my mother's family, they spoke Yiddish, and the Jews that came from Turkey and were Sephardic spoke an old Spanish called Ladino, and they maintained these differences in Cuba. I think it would have taken possibly another generation or two for more fusion to have taken place. I guess it was starting in the 50s, and when my parents got married, my mother being the daughter of Ashkenazi Jews who spoke Yiddish, and my father being the son of Sephardic Jews who spoke Ladino, Their marriage was considered an intermarriage at the time. Both families were kind of a little uncomfortable because they all remained very separate. They had separate synagogues and separate foods and separate schools even. The Yiddish immigrants had Yiddish newspapers, and the Sephardic immigrants had a Ladino newspaper. And so they were all kind of very, you know, very distinct within Cuba. But by the 50s, that was starting to happen. You know, they were starting to just become Cuban. But there wasn't enough time. I think if you know, things had been different and I had stayed, I would have been part of this next generation that it would have been more, you know, more Cuban perhaps and less kind of, you know, tribally Jewish in a sense, the way the community was. You know, at the time when it mostly dissolved after the revolution.
Well, I have a couple of other people here. I'm going to get to them, but just two quick questions. One, at the say on the eve of the revolution, how many Jewish Cubans were there?
There were about 15,000 kind of officially registered as Jews, meaning people who were members of synagogues and temples or secular Jewish organizations. But my sense is that there were many, many more people, many more Jews there who just weren't part of organizations, so therefore they couldn't be counted. My sense is that there were more like 20 to 25,000, I think, but only about 15 who were actually, you know, registered members of a Jewish organization. Mm.
And while most eventually, while most people left after the revolution, some people did stay. Now, today, to the extent that you can put a number on it, how many Jewish Cubans do you think there are?
Well, they say there's about 1,500. I think it's more like 1,000 at this point. So there's a small nucleus of people who stayed, and some of those people are still alive and in Cuba. And then there's many, many others who are a descendant of one Jewish ancestor, maybe a Jewish grandmother or grandfather. And then there are people who have married people of Jewish descent and who have converted and become part of the new community. So it's an interesting mix of kind of the pre-revolutionary Jews who are still there and kind of the new Jews. People have become Jewish since the 90s in Cuba.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ruth Behar. She's professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. She's the author of The Vulnerable Observer, Anthropology That Breaks Your Heart, and also director of the documentary Adio Querida, A Cuban Sephardic Journey, and a book that is very much in that same vein. It is about her experiences going back to Cuba, in part to connect with, investigate the traditions and the history and the experiences of her own family. She was actually born in Cuba, but left when she was a little girl. And as she explained earlier in our conversation, she didn't have a lot of personal memories of Cuba. But that connection still seemed to be very strong and one that she wanted to investigate, and did that over a number of years with a number of visits. Also, she was interested in finding out what remained of the Jewish community in Cuba. And all of that is a story that you can read in her book, An Island Called Home, Returning to Jewish Cuba. The publisher is the Rutgers University Press. Also, by the way, if you're just interested in finding out maybe a little bit more about her and some of her other work as an anthropologist, you can go to her website, which is ruthbehar.com, and her last name is spelled B-E-H-A-R. We do have some other callers here, and we will talk with them now. First is in line number one, and that's in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. You've partially answered the question. I was wondering how far back the Jewish community goes, because in medieval times, Spain had this marvelous Jewish Islamic culture in the south of Spain and Andalusia. And even after the forced conversions, there was a considerable underground Jewish community in Spain. And I was wondering if any of those people had migrated to the New World, and that was part of the community.
Yes, we don't really have evidence of a converso community, but we do know of some individual conversos. In fact, Columbus landed in Cuba with a man named Luis de Torres, who was known to be a converso. In other words, his family had been Jewish, but they converted to Catholicism under the pressure of the Inquisition and so on in the 15th century in Spain. And he was brought along with Columbus to, interestingly enough, to serve as a translator, because in addition to speaking Spanish, he also spoke Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic. So they thought he might be able to be helpful in communicating with the natives, not knowing what languages they would find. So he was there, and there's been some evidence of other kind of individual conversos, but we don't really have evidence of an underground community of any kind in Cuba. The Jewish community as such really takes form after the Spanish-American War of 1898, because until then, Cuba had been controlled by the Spanish crown, and no other religion was allowed on the island except for Catholicism. I mean, no outward display of any other religion. And so other religions, Judaism and Protestantism and so on, didn't become officially possible until after 1898. And the first Jews to arrive on the island were American Jewish expatriates. Some of them had actually fought in the Spanish-American War. And they started setting up a community in 1901.
Just a comment on the Latino language. It was more than just an archaic Spanish language. It was the contact language of the Mediterranean for centuries.
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you for that clarification.
Well, thank you. It's most interesting.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, and we'll talk again here with someone else. And this is a caller on our line number two. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Two quick comments. First, the experience of the Jewish community on Cuba is very parallel to the experience of the American Jewish community here, including my own, where the starting point was peddling and then moving into a general store and the gradual evolution from there. The second point is that there's a strong Cuban Jewish connection in our community. There is a retired physician who was born in Cuba, of parents who migrated from Turkey, and he has many interesting stories he tells about his experiences growing up in Cuba and then coming to the United States for his medical training.
Oh, that's so fascinating. Well, that was one of the most exciting things about my book tour. Everywhere I would go, I would of course find Cubans everywhere I go, because Cubans have immigrated everywhere, but I would also find Cuban Jews in the most unexpected places. In the community, the immigrant Cuban Jewish community is largely based in Miami and New York, but you find Cuban Jews really all over the United States. So I'm not surprised to hear of somebody in the Urbana area as well. It's very fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I've talked about the fact that part of your desire to go to Cuba was to, in a sense, connect with your own family experience, and you had the opportunity to go, and you could go back to the place where your parents had lived and so forth, and places where that you would have had no memory of, since, as we explained, you were just a few years old when they left Cuba. How was that experience, going back to those places where you had ties through your family? Maybe they were not personal in the sense that you had been there, but that these were family places.
Yes. Well, you know, it was very, very moving, particularly going back to the main synagogue in Havana. It's kind of what we would consider in the United States today a kind of Jewish community center. It's called the Patronato, and it's really the most magnificent synagogue in Cuba. And we lived exactly half a block away from it. The apartment building where we lived was just down the street, and we could see it from the windows of our apartment. So I'd always heard about this synagogue, and there's actually a picture of me that's also in the book, posed right in front of the facade of the synagogue. synagogue. So I had always kind of wondered about it. And then going back and actually being inside that synagogue and hanging out with people who now attend services there or attend various kinds of classes at that synagogue, it was very, very moving. And I kept feeling, oh, my God, I wish my mother and father, you know, could be seeing this, you know, see what I'm seeing. And, you know, the best that I could do, since they don't want to go back to Cuba, is, you know, bring it back to them in pictures and stories. And it was a kind of eerie feeling for me to, you know, to be back in that sacred space, you know, that had been important to them, where they had spent much of their time when they were young and, you know, starting their family. And then traveling through the rest of Cuba and just finding, you know, Jews scattered all over the island and forming little communities all over the island, and especially going off to the eastern end of the island to Santiago de Cuba and getting to know the community there and seeing the small but very beautiful synagogue that they have as well, which was actually the old synagogue that had been taken away by the state for several decades because nobody was using it anymore. So the state took it over, but then in the 90s they recovered it, and it was just really beautiful to, you know, to see that experience, to see people reclaiming their heritage and kind of being part of that, at least as an observer, was a very, very moving experience.
And I think here that it's worth underlining the point that we're talking about, even though that perhaps the size of the Jewish community in Cuba is much smaller than it was, is from a height of maybe 25,000 to now maybe about 1,000. This is indeed a living community, and that these people are practicing their faith. They're going to synagogue. They're educating their children, and it's a community that's going forward.
Absolutely, it is. Totally a living and a vibrant community. Relative to their size, they do a lot. And I think that's one of the reasons that people have been so captivated by this community. You probably know, and I mention it in the book, that many American Jews travel to Cuba on missions. It's one of the ways in which you can travel legally to Cuba, is if you go on a humanitarian or religious mission to bring aid to people in Cuba. And many synagogues and Jewish organizations have organized trips to Cuba. I speak to many of the people who are going, actually, often right before they go to Cuba. They ask me to speak to them to orient them a little bit. And people are always, people who go from the States and see that community are always just so completely captivated, because there is such passion and such feeling for the heritage, for Jewish memory, for maintaining these Jewish traces on the island. There's a real vibrancy and a real kind of activism, a very kind of grassroots activism that is always very, very moving to outsiders, who often feel that that they take their own, you know, Jewishness for granted, the privilege to be able to maintain a heritage, to maintain a religion, that they take it for granted here, where this is just an assumed, you know, human right that we have. But when they go to Cuba and kind of see people living under very difficult and restricted economic conditions, and to see them so happily maintaining a heritage and being part of a heritage, it's extremely moving to anybody, I think, who goes to Cuba to see that phenomenon.
So we talked about the fact that over time a lot of Cuba's Jews left, and among them were your family, but that some people did stay and make the decision to stay. And one of the questions you were interested in exploring, trying to get a better understanding of, is for those people who chose to stay, why?
Mm-hmm.
Why it is they stayed. Do you come away with some answers to that question?
Oh, yes, yes, definitely. Well, there were a range of reasons. There were some Jews who were very involved in the revolution. Some of them were communists and became members of the Communist Party. So there was some Jewish involvement in that way. One of the founders of the Cuban Communist Party was a Jewish immigrant from Poland, So there had definitely been this kind of strong, you know, Jewish communist presence. So some people were just politically in support of the revolution and wanted to stay and be part of it, regardless of the hardships that they knew that they would suffer. And some members of that community, many have passed away, but there's still several who are in Cuba, largely in Havana. And they're a very, very interesting group of you know, Jewish intellectuals who are not in any way religious, but definitely identify as Jewish by heritage. So there's that group of people. Then there are people who married out of the tribe, married Cubans who weren't Jewish, and just became more involved in their Cuban identity and in the Cuban Revolution, and stayed because they just felt so supremely Cuban they couldn't imagine immigrating to another country. So there's that group of people. And then there were people who just didn't have the means, the contacts, to be able to leave the country and establish themselves elsewhere. So there were also Jews who just were poor and stayed behind. So largely that was what I found. Those were the three kind of groups of people and the three sets of reasons that people chose to stay rather than to leave. And to this day, there's a woman that I write about in the book who could leave at any moment if she wanted to. Both her daughters left Cuba in the 90s, and one is in Puerto Rico and one is often in Norway, and they have tried and tried and tried to convince her to leave, and she feels very much a part of Cuba and of the revolution, and she has chosen to stay. So you do find those stories as well, and I think it's very important to be aware of them, that not everybody chose to leave, and that staying was also a good decision for the people who chose that.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Ruth Behar. She is professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. We are talking about some of what you will find in her recent book, An Island Called Home, Returning to Jewish Cuba. And it's published by the Rutgers University Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in maybe having you talk a little bit about, over the time that you have been going to Cuba, how you have seen the country change, and what sort of thoughts or maybe concerns you have about the future. In this sense, I think that there are a lot of people who are maybe concerned about what happens when the country continues to open up. And, you know, I think there are some people, and maybe it's those people who are maybe a little overly romantic about the way that it is and was, and are afraid that essentially it's going to turn into South Florida. It's just, you know, that it won't, that you won't be able to tell the difference. And I guess I'm just really interested in what you think, and perhaps also what people that you have met and come to know in Cuba think about how the country, as things go forward, and one can hope for more openness, or at least a, you know, more positive relationship with the United States and so forth, maybe making it easier for people to go from this country, how that's likely to change Cuba, and in fact whether people are concerned about what sort of changes might take place.
Yes, well, this is a very, very interesting question. I think, you know, the next 4 years now that Obama has just become president, I think will be very, probably very significant for the history of Cuba, the new history of Cuba. And, you know, I have been observing a lot of changes over the last 18 years. You know, when I got there in the early 90s, it was a moment of tremendous, tremendous crisis. They had just broken with the Soviet Union. The former Soviet Union had collapsed. Cuba suddenly had to find a way to make it in the capitalist world without all the subsidies that the Russians had been providing. And it was a moment of really just great, great stress, economic and moral stress in the country. And then it seemed that everything was going to fall apart, but Cuba decided to turn towards tourism, towards some investment from capitalist countries, particularly European and Latin American
countries and develop the whole hotel sector. And so the 90s was this moment when Cuba began to open up to the rest of the world, not totally to the United States, but certainly to the rest of the world, and many, many people who hadn't traveled to Cuba began to travel to Cuba in the 90s, including many Americans who did go during the Clinton era in the 90s. And so we began to get a lot more information from Cuba, many more photographs and stories about what was going on the island. And the island began to change. I think, they kind of found a way to interconnect socialism with capitalism, at least. On the island, people always make a joke of everything, and the more cynical people say, yes, what we started getting in Cuba was capitalism for the government and socialism for the people, because many of these new investments really, helped to maintain the government, essentially. So Cuba opened up. There's certainly more awareness of the rest of the world by the end of the 90s. And that was an important change, and the whole development of a double economy, an economy in Cuban pesos and an economy in dollars, and then later in convertible currency. So I think just much more kind of involvement with the rest of the world, much more curiosity with the United States from Cuba, and a desire to really get to know Americans, I think, one-on-one, I think was a very important shift in the 90s and through to these first years, first decade of this century as well. So I think a lot of us who love certain aspects of Cuba as it is today do worry about what will happen in the future. Many people that I've interviewed to find out why they're so attracted to Cuba, I call them Cuba addicts, or people who travel to Cuba frequently, and they say that what they love about Cuba is that McDonald's isn't there. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people want to see, the aspects of Cuba that are so unique in comparison to the rest of the world. People want to see that, stay the same, Cuba without McDonald's. I think that there's a desire for that. There's a desire to maintain the beauty of Havana. There's been very, very little new construction in Havana, so it doesn't look anything like Miami because you don't have all that glass and steel, all those new condominiums. You don't have that because there was no new construction in Havana since 59, so that's why it looks like a city preserved in amber, certainly the old part of the city, not so much the new part, but the old part. And there's something beautiful about that. So I think that there's a need, in the next few years to work with people in architectural conservation and so on to maintain, the beauty of this city that is so unique because it hasn't been overrun by all of them. So I think that's one of the concerns. And I think on another level, there's a concern, whatever happens in Cuba in the next few years, to definitely maintain the good achievements of the revolution, which included, excellent education for everybody in the country and excellent health care, among other important achievements.
Yeah. I wonder the reaction of some Cubans, at least, to those people, Americans and others, who come to Cuba precisely for the reason that you cited, because there is no McDonald's, because it seems that it's a city almost frozen in time. I wonder they feel maybe a little irritated or possibly even a little bit resentful of this idea that they might say, "Well, are we not entitled to modernize? You want us to stay in 1953 because you think it's charming for you want to come here and spend a week and you think that's charming? Well, we got to live here all the time." can we not do a little something to come into the 21st century?
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, I think some people definitely feel that way, and I'm sure that, I could go back to Cuba when I go back now in the next couple of months and do a survey and say, would you like McDonald's to be here and everything that implies, or would you not? And I think it's going to be a complex thing. I think, yes, that people do, a lot of people do want more modernization, but I think a lot of people in Cuba are also very concerned about losing what they did achieve over the last 50 years. Cuba just celebrated its 50th
anniversary of its revolution, and I think that there is a concern that, that things might change too quickly, that capitalism might come in a little too savagely and, you know, and take away the positive achievements and take away even a kind of, you know, slowness of life that I think some people actually on the island appreciate. I mean, I think you're right. I think that, you know, we definitely don't want to just preserve Cuba in amber just so that it could be, you know, a cute vacation spot for foreigners. I don't think it's that, but I think it's is to maintain its uniqueness. I think that's what's going to be important to, as a friend of mine in Cuba says, he goes, you know, I think in the next few years, Cuba is going to be just like any other country. And he lamented that. I think there's this, you know, sense of, no, we don't want to make it any other country. There's something exceptional about Cuba and what Cuba accomplished despite so much antagonism from the United States over so many decades. Their uniqueness, you know, and it's the good and the bad and the ugly, you know, the unique revolution at the same time, all the economic hardships, the lack of political freedom, but at the same time, something very magical was also created there.
So going back to the point where we began, we started out with the story that you begin the book with about visiting your grandmother in Miami on your way to Cuba, and she's saying, what, you're going again? And you talked about this common expression among Cuban Americans. What did you lose in Cuba? Did you find something there yourself? What did you find in Cuba?
I found a lot of things. I think I found a kind of core of who I am and who my community is and who my people are. I think I just came back with a bigger heart. You know, I think what I gained is I understood what my family lost. And I think that was just so central. I think I had not really been compassionate enough what they lost and really what, you know, what all Cubans lost and continue to lose when they leave. And it's this extraordinary place, this extraordinary island, this beautiful, beautiful pearl of the Antilles, as Columbus called it. And I think that was what I gained, a real sense of what they lost and, you know, how terrible it must have been. I was a little girl, and I didn't understand. But, you know, for people who were adults, you know, and understood what they were losing, that was so huge. And I think being there and just kind of seeing, you know, the beauty of Cuba, its beautiful landscape and architecture, and just the warmth and genuineness of the people in Cuba on a kind of very, very basic human level, this huge kindness that I feel. I feel very safe there because I feel people are just so warm and so grounded and such, you know, good human beings. So I think that was what I gained, as I gained a sense of what they lost, what my family and community lost. And I think that in turn just made my heart bigger and made me feel more compassion and empathy for, you know, for the sadness that you often find, the melancholy that you often find, you know, in the Cuban immigrant and exile community, you know, this sense that, oh, my God, you know, we lost something wonderful and we had to try to recreate it as best we could in the United States. And I think even people who prospered tremendously in the United States, many of the Cuban Jews who left in the 60s are now enormously wealthy in Miami. I think there's still this sense of loss, you know, that there was this possibility of a really amazing life to come in Cuba that they were building in the 50s with these synagogues, you know, that were built in the 50s expecting to stay and then finding that they had to leave. And I think just being able to see it all with my own eyes and experience it and, you know, and step in those same places where they had stepped, you know, stand in those places where they had stood, I think that just made me understand them a little bit more than I had before.
Our guest this morning, Ruth Behar, is professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. If you'd like to read her book, it is An Island Called Home, Returning to Jewish Cuba, and it's published by the Rutgers University Press. Also, you can look at her website, ruthbehar.com, find out more about her and her work. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, David. It was a pleasure.
And you're listening to a program from the Focus Archives, first broadcast on January 21st of this year. Our show, Focus 580, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information at bodyworkassociates.com. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine. Hosting the show today is Tom Rogers.
Hello, Dave. Good morning, everybody. And coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today, our monthly look at dog training and dog behavior. Jim Keel and Carol Lindholm from the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana will join us. That's in the 1 o'clock hour after our noon hour look at news. Looking at the commodity markets right now, a mixed day right now. The wheat is up by and large. May wheat in Kansas City is up 11 and 3/4 cents a bushel now at 603 and a quarter, maybe on weather concerns. May wheat in Chicago is up 6 and 3/4 at 557 and a quarter. July is